Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm very pleased to welcome you on behalf of Tafelberg and NB Publishers to this morning's discussion between Bill Nassen and Johan Meiberg of Bill's latest book, World War I and the People of South Africa. Before I hand over to them, I'm going to just say a few words about Bill. Not that I think that he needs introduction from this audience, but just to do things properly. Bill is one of South Africa's leading historians. At the moment, he is Distinguished Professor of History at the University of Stellenbosch. He studied at the Universities of Hull and York in Britain. He has a PhD from Cambridge University, and he was at the University of Cape Town for 20 years, where he was head of the Department of History. He has held visiting fellowships at a number of distinguished universities, University of Cambridge, the Australian National University, Yale, University of Illinois, University of Kent, and Trinity College in Dublin. Bill specializes in the history of war, but he writes also about a variety of other subjects, including education, politics, and oral history. His book, The War for South Africa, which was published in 2010, was shortlisted for the Alan Paton Non-Fiction Award, and won the Recht Maland Prize. Last year he and co-author Albert Grinling also won the Kijknet Rapport Award for non-fiction with The War at Home, which was also published in Afrikaans as Die Oorlog by die Huis. Okay, and Bill will be in discussion with Johan Meiberg of Radio Helderberg, and we look forward to listening to you, and thank you both for being here.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you. I was asked the other day if I could invite five people to a dinner party, who I'll invite, and one of the people were Professor Bill Nassen. I thought that would be very interesting. There's a difference between the World War One that you explained to us, what we know and what you give us, Prof. And the thing is, what you do, you actually start before 1914. I think what's going to be interesting for us to just set the scene in South Africa before the First World War in South Africa.
I mean, I think the thing to say really is that South Africa is quite a lot like a lot of other countries. I mean, in many ways it's different, but it's a lot like Australia and New Zealand and Ireland and Britain itself. As a krom gemors wat aangaan, 1913, 1914, das betogings, I mean, there are strikes, there are mass demonstrations. The world is going through this this period of unrest, and there's this wonderful, die wonderlijke Duitse a dichter, what is it, Otto Dix of so, and he geskryf, yeah, the world needs a big enema. This was a drukkoker, and something has to happen. So South Africa is convulsed by strikes. There's Gandhi's campaign against discrimination against Indians, white railway workers, white mine workers are on strike, and wat se Jannie Smuts voor die oorlog? You know, daar's 'n groot vraag vir hierdie land. Daar's net een probleem. Daar is the ignorant natives and the ignorant Dutch. In other words, the ignorant arme blankes. And the country's problem just before the war, this is very familiar, dink terug aan Marikana, is altyd vreemde agents in hierdie land. So the problem in South Africa are British trade unionists and Australian trade unionists who are here in 1912, 1913, 1914, besig met opstokerij, and Smuts, of course, deports them because that is the solution to the problems in South Africa. That's a kind of domestic situation, and then regionally does work aangaan because there are concerns about German expansion and the sea routes and the need to protect the security of the new union. So there's a kind of, you know, there's a lot going on before war actually breaks out.
And then the war happens. And what you do with the book is you explain to us before 1914, and I think it's very important to remember, because this is kind of like a new angle to it. Then the war happens. And there's confusion before 1914. Now it's war in South Africa. So there's a little bit of chaos happening politically in South Africa.
Yeah, I mean, what's the general, I forget the name now, it's out of my is in the book. And you say, yes, I mean, we are ready to mobilize, we are ready to go out and fight, but who are we going to, who are we meant to fight, the British or the Germans? And that's a bit like, you know, British soldiers who crossed the Channel in 1914, and they go to France, and wat dink hulle, wie is die vijande? Is die blerry Franse? Is a groot skok. Is die Duitse? Ons moet daar veg met die Duitse. And that's not the expectation of hundreds of British soldiers. They go to France thinking, you know, the traditional enemy is the French. Met die wijn en die kaas en al die goed. And that, and South Africa, I mean, magnifies all of those, you know, because for many people, as we know, for nationalists, the enemy is not Germany, it's the British, it's England.
Mm. What is the connection with the Afrikaner and the German? Have you ever sorted that out?
Well, that's a kind of old thing. I mean, it's all kinds of, you know, social and ethnic, whatever links. And then, you know, moenie vergeet van die Kaiser's telegram. Dink terug aan die Jameson raid and the famous telegram from the Kaiser expressing support for the rights of the Boer republics, the rights to freedom and liberty and self-determination. So there's an old thing. So the Germans have an old kind of have a well-established links with the Boer republics. And if you think of the, you know, Zuid-Afrikaanse Anglo-Boer oorlog, I mean, one of the things the British were very worried about was the increasing investment. German interest, German investment in the Transvaal, in helping to establish a national bank and establishing harbour facilities at Delagoa Bay, so that the Zuid-Afrikaanse Republic kan 'n bietjie meer onafhanklik wees. And so the British were worried about those old links, which of course continue, and you get all this. I mean, I didn't talk about this in the book, but there are German novels written in 1900, about South Africa being a sagte plek.
Mm.
As 'n oorlog kom, is dit 'n sagte plek. And these are novels about German agents coming in and subverting, and Smuts makes a big deal about this, which is when war breaks out. I mean, it's a difficult thing in Parliament, you know. There's no consensus. And then what happens? You know, twee honderd Duitse soldate klim oor, and they cross the border with a moerse klomp bier en so. And they camp a little bit on a mountain and vakansie tyd. And Boerte staan op in parliament and said, ja, hier kom die Duitse. Ons moet nou begin baklei.
Also, the scary thing about South Africa, somebody, one of the politicians did say, if only South Africa could be like New Zealand. Mm. I mean, easy. Mm. So we know which side they're going to take. But it's not the case here with us.
I mean, New Zealand is a, you know, never mind rugby. but New Zealand is a perfect place. It's completely pro-British. I mean, it's more royalist than parts of Britain. So is Australia. But Australia's is a bietjie meer moeilik because they can't. There's a conscription issue in Australia. So Australia doesn't have conscription. And South Africa, as we know, doesn't have conscription. There's no mass conscription here. Everybody who goes to the war, I mean, even black and coloured volunteers. I mean, there's a bicky chicanery and cajoling among chiefs and magistrates. But generally, everybody here is a volunteer. It's dis jou keuse. It's very interesting. South Africa is, an interesting example. There's no conscription. There's no mass conscription. And so you don't get the kind of anti-conscription rebellions you get in other colonial territories in West Africa and North Africa.
Prof, how on earth did we overcome the divisions we had in South Africa to have these First World War? Because, I mean, complications all the way. It must have been extremely complicated for politicians between 1914 and 18, just to keep us intact.
Yeah, I mean, it is an interesting issue. If you think of the invasion of German Southwest, which was invaded for a whole range of reasons, but one of the reasons why the British Governor General, Joh Buxton, was very keen on that, and he was very keen on East Africa, because that is a way to unite the white population. Anglo-Afrikaner saamkom. Once you conquer another territory, there'll be a groot, you know, opvloeding van national feeling and unity and patriotism. And that's a way to paper over the political divisions within the country, within parliament and more widely. Maar het werkt niet, because we know, you know, if we look at the election of 1915 and so on, it's Boot and Smuts is moeilijk. I mean, they are wounded, they're not dead, but their fortunes are declined. The fortunes decline because of the war.
Net sê dat ons gaan definitief vrae stel na die tyd van u kant af, so u kan, ek weet, die koppe werk en daar's baie vrae wat u ook wil hoor, so ons gaan u tyd gee daarvoor. Die ander ding wat vir my nogal interessant is, is die Afrikaner in hierdie periode. Ek meen, ons was die regtig die moeilikheidmakers van die wêreld, as ek het so kan stel, natuurlik op 'n klein skaal, maar ek meen, daar het baie ons voorbeelde gevolg, as het kom by opstande, proteste, so it seems as if it's kind of like a South African thing, this whole protest, which was started by the Afrikaner.
You mean the...
Well, the protest, anti-government, and...
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, there is a kind of thing about South Africa that I sometimes think about it now, as an historian. I mean, is South Africa really governable? that's a vraag. I mean, the previous nationalists discovered that to their cost. By the time you get to the 1980s, South Africa is not governable. And the new set of nationalists we have now, I think discovering some of the same things. So I think it's like a serious question. Is South Africa really governable? And mense is moeilik in hierdie plek. That's what it is. You know, I think that there's a very strong, it's a new world society and it comes out of a particular kind of colonial past. But I think it's very interesting, actually. I mean, so for example, if you take, vat nou hierdie oorlog. So what happens? So the Germans are rounded up, German civilians, and treated as enemy aliens. And confined in what effectively are kind of concentration camps. I mean, there's one in Pietermaritzburg, and then there's one in, which is the Rand Showgrounds in Johannesburg. Mm-hmm. And so anybody with a kind of German-sounding name, I mean, possibly my esteemed colleague, Professor Grunling, was, uitgetrek uit die Wolkshof gebou in Pietermaritzburg toe gestuur. But in fact, what happens is that when you go into small rural towns, and there are Germans living there, amongst Afrikaner people, is moeilik vir Smuts, because they are being protected by people they consider to be with whom they feel they have some bond. So at every level, is moeilik. It's difficult here, actually. Yeah.
Die uniekheid van die boek ook is dat Yves beskryf prachtig vir ons wat gebeur voor 1914. Dan is dit die 4 jaar Eerste Wêreldoorlog. Maar dan.
Eerste Wêreldoorlog wat 4 jare.
Ja, ja, en dan kom ons by 1918, wat die einde van die oorlog internasionaal beteken, maar dan is daar 'n komplikasie weer eens in Suid-Afrika oor die oorwinning of nie oorwinning en wat dan gebeur. Could you just explain to us, because in your book you go from 1918 onwards explaining, and then it becomes an international issue.
Ja, I mean, one part of this is about the achievements of Greater South Africa, and particularly, I mean, Slim Janney is the key figure in all of this. Because if you take Vat nou die oorlog and Slim Janney, and Slim Janney was nie 'n goeie generaal nie in Oos-Afrika. Geen kos vir die troepies, en Kersfeesdag 1917, daar's niks. And it was by a face. Scarce face. And so Slim Janney, if you think of the First World War, when the generals are all seen as useless, né? But by the time you get to 1918, V's Field Marshal Haig, the greatest Scottish general in history because he killed most Englishmen. And Janney Smuts's work kind of, he's kind of useless in East Africa. But what happens after 1918? He becomes a great imperial statesman. And he spends his time drinking tea with the Queen and going to London. And he's a great hero in London. And the kind of Slechte Generalskap kind of disappears for for Yanni. And then, of course, South Africa. And, of course, part of it is, you know, part of this great push, you know, the what amounts to the annexation of Saint Wes and the failed attempt to take West Africa, Deutsche Ostafrika. I mean, that fails. But what Smuts and Botha do by 1918 is that they do establish South Africa as a significant country in the on the international stage. And I mean, you know, once we had Smuts and the mandate system, and they establish a South African presence on the Western Front in France, you know, Dinknow and Delville Wood in Suez. Mm-hmm. So in fact, they kind of export South Africa to other parts of the world. And it was a baie belangrike project for Daardie twee.
Ons het nooit die situasie regtig erken en oorkom van die hele storie van Brittanje en Duitsland vir ons as mense van Suid-Afrika nie. Dis altyd daai konflik gewees, nê, tussen die wat ek kan staan, jy is jy links of is jy reg?
Nee, dis nie altyd die storie nie. I mean, it's fascinating actually. I mean, if you there were German politicians and German academics who were going to Cambridge and Oxford up to the early months of 1914 to get honorary doctorates. There were German musicians. I mean, you weet julle van the Christmas truce. You know that famous, there's that famous moment in Christmas 1914 playing football. You know, voor al die slagtery. Okay, is nou vroeg in die oorlog, is voor die slagtery, voor die som, en is Kersfees. En is 'n bietjie koud, en mense staan op en sing, and the Germans start singing Heilige Nacht, and the British soldiers sing Good King Wenceslas, and then the German soldiers sing Good King Wenceslas. And what was that about? A lot of the German soldiers had been to Britain, and had gone back when the war started. And they'd had a gap year. They were working as waiters in restaurants and cutting hair and au pairs and so on. And so they were very familiar with English, and the English were less familiar with the Germans. But there wasn't that, can you see, it wasn't traditionally, I mean, the traditional enemy of the British were always, dieselfde story vandag, always the French. Mm. Not the Germans. So there's this long kind of, you know, Anglo-German or Duitse wat Engels goed ken. It's not always the other ones. We had Engels sprekendes are famously eentalig. We try our best. But it's interesting that it's something that starts up met die Duitse vloot. I mean, once the Germans start expanding the navy and that gets underway, and you get the whole naval race in the early 1900s, then that starts the antagonism. Once the British feel, you know, that the Germans are going to be a threat to the empire around the world, and that the Germans will change the balance of power in Europe by turning what Germany traditionally likes to do, by turning Russia into Germany, and France into Germany, and Belgium into Germany. En is 'n groot skrok vir die Britte. Daai soort goed. But it's not inevitable or automatic. It's like something that's, you know, as a Kaiser. Daai ou.
Prof, explain to us 1918 and what happens internationally after the war.
Well, what happens internationally? I mean, what happens, yeah. I mean, what happens in this country? I mean, in some ways you could say, you know, ons sit hier nou. And there's not a big thing about the First World War in South Africa. Né? Is it reg? I mean, if you compare this with what's going on around other parts of the world. And it's an interessante vraag. En vir my is daar meer as een antwoord. Jy kan 'n politieke antwoord gee. South Africa was divided. And so the legacy of the war was a little bit divided. And so that is why we're not taking part in lots of commemorative activities like Australia or New Zealand or South Africa. I'll get back to 1918 in a minute. And this, you know, die tweede antwoord is miskien, jy kan sê, sleg vir die mense wat dood is. But you could say, wat is die story van die oorlog vir Suid-Afrika? Moerse groot oorlog nie te veel mense dood nie. So this is a kind of menslike antwoord. I mean, South Africa, I've got the figure in the book, the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, is about 10,000 people who die as a direct consequence of the war. And if you compare that with other societies, you know, it's, compare it with take a country like Serbia. Serbia, 70% of Serbian men between the ages of 16 and 40 were killed. 70%. Unbelievable, actually. So this country never had, you know what I mean, never had that kind of the impact of death. And the ander ding is hierdie plek mense het van oorlog geken. I mean, there was a big war here 12 years before the First World War comes. And you get that sense from particular, I mean, obviously particularly from Afrikaners, ons weet van oorlog, ons wil nie nog 'n oorlog hê wat erger is as hierdie een. And so there's a very strong, I think there's a kind of almost a recoil actually, or a kind of, you know, like a repulsion really. And of course South Africa kind of escapes it in a way. I mean, that's the interesting thing. I mean, you know, what was it? The Spanish flu kills people here. Is nie die oorlog nie. En wie praat nou van die flu? 360,000 mense in 3 maande of so in 1918. Ja. En die hele Eerste Wêreldoorlog 10,000 of so. So die oorlog hier, ja, die oorlog hier is die flu. Is die griep. Is 'n griepoorlog. And, you know, and the flu is linked to the war, so it's kind of, yeah.
And there's also no clarity about Britain.
Okay, I didn't get on to 1980, wacht net, okay. No, it's fine, gaan maar aan, we'll get back, yeah.
Yeah. No clarity about Britain at this stage, because after 1918, we were still divided when it comes to Britain, but not only here, also internationally.
Yeah. There's no doubt about that. I mean, that the divisions over the nature of South Africa's relationship with Britain, I mean, it's complicated, but of course it's divided. I mean, you know, Smuts and people like Denise Rates, onedie kombers met die Britte. I mean, there's no ambiguity or uncertainty about that. So it's a kind of, you know, I think it's not kind of one thing or the other. It's like a complicated, I mean, what is the right, Rates write about the Afrikaner rebellion. I mean, what does he say in Trekking On, you know? And he says, what is the rebellion? The rebellion is not teen die Britte nie, whatever. The rebellion is teen die ryk Afrikaners, or die ryk boere hier, mense wat tevrede is met die lewe. And so that's what he says, you know, the rebellion is not a kind of nationalist or republican rebellion. It's almost a kind of rebellion of as Albert Grinling and Sandra Swart have written, a kind of desperate, radeloose rebellion of people who are discontent and chafing and hurtful with their lot. Yeah.
When you as a historian look back at World War One in and what has happened in the world, what do you see? World War One, what did it do for us in the world?
Well, yes,
when it comes to power, especially with power, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there are all kinds of things about, what can, I guess, no moeg van die Eerste Wêreldoorlog in some ways. Nie vandag nie, maar, you know. Ek is bly, die Tweede Wêreldoorlog in teorie sal lang dood wees. So, dis, yeah. What is the First War given us? Dink nou. Camembert cheese and die triangular stukkies that was to fit into the backpacks of French soldiers. Voor die oorlog was 'n moeilike klomp cheddar cheese slabs of camembert, and if you think of your restaurants and aeroplanes, you're going to your little sugar in these little suckies, you know, klein sugary ding, maar vir die suiker is die Eerste Wêreldoorlog. Shortage of sugar, you ration sugar, and it's good for manufacturers because it's cheap, so you keep it. Trench coats, horloosies, allei goed. is die Eerste Wereldoorlog. Op een kind of, you know, gewone menselijke thing. Winnie Mandela in the trenches in the 1980s. Malema likes to talk about the trenches. Is it neat? If you say you're going over the top, or don't go over the top, waar komt dit? Is die Eerste Wereldoorlog. Is I like trench goed. So I think, so at one level there's all that. And at the other level you could say, you know, it has shaped the modern world. I mean, before the First World War, people did not have passports. If you wanted to go to a country, you didn't need a passport. You didn't need identity documents. Klim op 'n skip, sit die goud in jou sak, get off at the other end, because it's the gold standard, gaan bank toe en sê, waar is die papier vir my goud? That's how you did it. Never mind Thomas Cook and all that good. Or Rennie's Travel. Okay. So all of those things, so there you get. You get identity cards and you get passports and you get the regulation of citizens and the identification of citizens by government. So you get this kind of surveillance thing that comes in during the First World War. And it's baie lekker vir die regering. It's good. We can now keep tabs on the population. And then if you think of the, you know, the global order of the world, I mean, the second colonial, I mean, in a sense, afterwards you get this recolonization of parts of Africa and the British, and it dates as uitgeskop. Yeah? So the British Empire expands, and so the scramble for Africa, which starts in the 1880s, is kind of klaar nou by 1918, and that sets the stage. And I mean, there's a famous New Zealand historian called Trevor Wilson, who my publishers will enjoy this, who said to me, the thing about being an historian, you must never write about the present or the future. It's te gevaarlik. Okay. You know. Yeah. And I said, why? He said, well, he wrote this massive book about the First World War in about 1975. I'm showing my age here now. And he said he thought, die ding is so sleg, is so ugh. And he was trying to find, is daar enig iets klein, iets wat positief is uit die Eerste Wereldoorlog? Nie net die kamabetjies en trenchcoats en so. En hy het gesê, ja, Yugoslavia. Yugoslavia is the positive creation which comes out of the First World War. And as his editor was saying, lekker, the book is now being printed. Yeah, Bosnia and uitgebreek. And so, yeah.
As a historian, were you surprised, or are you surprised that it took 20 years for the Second World War?
No, because the First World War... it's very interesting, actually. I mean, Botha and Smuts, there are three important figures, okay? There's John Maynard Keynes, the famous English economist, who said of the peace treaty, straf nou die Duitser, okay? The Germans have all the blame for the war and they must pay. And he says it's a groot fout, because what that does is that's going to lay the ground for the Germans to be alienated and angry. And he doesn't predict Hitler, but he says, there's, you know, daar's moeilikheid wat kom. And in hierdie plek, Botha and Smuts, and the Versailles Peace Treaty, Smuts writes about this constantly. His heart is sore about what is happening to the Germans. And have countries not learned? I mean, have they not taken lessons from our Anglo-Boer Oorlog, where the British and the Boer leaders came together, and what did the British do? The British didn't, in terms of international law, force the Boer republics to pay for the war, because hulle het die oorlog begin, technically. So technically, if you start a war, you pay for it under sort of international law. So the British had kind of been, you know, clement, they exercised clemency, and there was kind of, and they committed themselves to Nazi bow and so on their own terms, of course, but still. And then 1918, the Germans are geklap constantly, And Boot and Smuts say, you know, Smuts writes about how heavy-hearted it is, and he predicts that this is a big mess, and Europe is left in a mess. And he writes very movingly about, you know, Europe is dark indeed. And there's that moment where he takes the veterans of the Mountain Club of South Africa to McClure's Beacon and gives this groot kind of gesprekkie about the future. And he says the future of Europe is a European South Africa. Europe is opgemors. And the only future for Europe is here in South Africa, for a great white European Africa to stretch up and finish what it started in the war. You know, the eerste ding was Suidwes and Oost-Afrika nie gebeur nie. But we will carry on and civilize the rest of Africa the way today Standard Bank and Whitey Besson and our captains of industry are helping to civilize the rest of Africa, financially anyway.
Nog iets vir my wat jy pragtig beskryf in hierdie boek van jou oor Wêreldoorlog 1 is dat dinge in Suid-Afrika gebeur wat nogal redelik parallel is. En ek dink dit vir my was dit ongelooflik vars om te sien dinge wat in Suid-Afrika gebeur, maar dan ook internasionaal. Het jy presies dieselfde tipe van ooreenkomste?
Dis reg, ja. Yeah. I think it's very important. I mean, we live in this country and we're all obsessed with kind of, you know, South African exceptionalism, or what's distinctive and what's different about South Africa. There are things that are, maar as ook baie dinge wat ons samehou met baie ander lande. And you see this during the war and after the war. It's very similar. I mean, you know, Afrikaner rebels are not unlike Irish rebels, are not unlike Algerian rebels and Tunisian rebels. Gatvol met die Franse during the war when they conscript them. And so South Africans share a lot with other parts of... jy is reg, ja.
As jy as historicus gaan terugkyk eendag na die tyd van ons nou, in die toekomst vorentoe, en dit is nou nie deel van hierdie gesprek nie, maar net vir interessantheidshalwe, dan is hierdie, the whole trend is still happening. From what we have here in South Africa is also happening everywhere else in the world.
Oh, you mean now?
Yeah. yes. Kom ons vra, is daar enigiemand van u wat nog 'n vraag wil vra? Hierdie is 'n baie baie belangrike kwessie vir ons oor die wêreldoorlog en die eerste ene veral omdat ek redelik ingelig was. Ek dink mens neig meer na die Tweede Wêreldoorlog toe, mens vergeet van wat werklik die situasie was in Suid-Afrika. Enige vraag van u kant af wat u vir prof wil vra asseblief? Ja, dame.
Ja, dat is een interessante vraag. Ik denk het is meer als een gevolg als een reden. I mean, what happened? Is bij interessant. Because die diamant is niet een groot ding in die propaganda en zo. En is Oppenheimer wat doppo. Dus die ding. Is Ernest Oppenheimer. Because einde van 1915, Suidwes is nou in die sak, and there's a fire sale or a war sale of Duitse assets in Suidwes. And wie is die eerste man daar? Harry O. Ernest O. Die O. Nie die Harry O.
Die O.
Die O, ja. And of course, it's by goedkoop, you know, it's bargain basement cheaper than Pep or Checkers. So dis reg. And there's a groot ding met die spoorweë en Walvis Bay and investment and trade and dis reg. And ook die migrasie van arme blankes van die Noord-Kaap oor die grens gestuur om nuwe kolonist te wees en so. Lekker vraag, dankie.
Enig iemand anders? I think we did a good job this morning.
Well,
no. Prof, Prof, yeah. The other thing I want to ask you is that as a historian, when you look at First World War and our participation in that, and what becoming the 20 years later for the Second World War. I personally, and this is purely personal, and what do I know, is that daar was nie vir my regtig 'n groeiproses in ons siege om ons anders te laat dink vir die Tweede Wêreldoorlog nie. Dis amper vir my asof daar 'n gedeelte van Suid-Afrika maar eenvoudig met daardie element gegaan het en ons het net ingetrap in die Tweede Wêreldoorlog in. En
ja,
en daar is steeds daai hele daar was regtig vir my baie confusion tydens in Suid-Afrika tydens die Eerste en die Tweede Wêreldoorlog. Ek dink nie ons
is reg. I mean die you know confusion and so is erg in die Tweede Wêreldoorlog. En ek dink aan die tweede is where I can say, you know, daar was 'n party mense is 'n groot avontuur en groot toerisme of so in die Eerste Wêreldoorlog. Kom ons gaan veg. Ons dink nie ons gaan dood frik wees. Maar lekker, né? En die wêreld en wat sê mense in 1914? Ag, dit's 'n kort oorlog. Yes.
Hmm.
Ons terug Kersfees of so, 3 maande, 4 maande, soos die Anglo-Boereoorlog, né? Wat die Britte gesê in 18 Oktober 1899. Hoe lank? 3 maande, 4 maande. Hoeveel soldate? 20.000 of so. Wat is die koste? 400.000 rand, ja. En 3,5 jaar later is het, you know, whatever, 350.000 soldaten, miljoenen pond en so. En die Eerste Wereldoorlog is dieselfde ding. In 1914. Vinnig, klaarmaak en huis toe. En so, hier kom die Tweede Wereldoorlog, en daar is party mense wat gaan, en daar is mense wat hou van oorlog. Dis, you know, dit is 'n ding. Daar is mense wat van oorlog hou. And so you get this flock to the colors, but a lot of people are, it's very difficult in the Second World War to get the kind of whatever you call, you know, war enthusiasm or oorlog atmosphere or enthousiasme for oorlog. En die Tweede Wêreldoorlog, wat jy gesien, 'n bietjie. I mean, nie so, ja, 'n bietjie in die Eerste Wêreldoorlog.
Ek dink wat ek ook wil oorbring is dat wat ek voel deur hierdie boek te gewerk het, was dat die verskillende magte wat ondersteun is gedurende die Eerste Wêreldoorlog in Suid-Afrika, niks het verander regtig in die Tweede Wêreldoorlog nie. Dit voel vir my waar ek in nou staan in 2015 dat nog steeds het niks verander in Suid-Afrika nie. We are really quite a divided country, if I can put it like that. And it's baie, baie duidelik deur ons geskiedenis. Is this also happening in other countries? As a historian, would you also say that? Or do you think they're more united than what we are here in South Africa?
Ja. Ja, see. Ja, partij van hulle is meer, you know, united or...
Well, the process was a little bit easier.
And the process was a little easier, but I mean, it's by a, you know, it's belangrijk. Vat nou Ierland. Vat Ierland, net een ander plek. Is moeilijk in Ierland. Jy is katholiek. Jy is protestant. En is een groot ding in die Eerste Wereldoorlog. Voor die Ierse. Vecht voor die Britte. Ach nee. Jy moet voor vrijheid vreg. Voor Ierland. En dink aan die Tweede Wereldoorlog. There's the Irish Republican Army. The IRA is functioning. And Ireland is very divided in the second. I mean, if you ons ken vir wie is hy? Robbie Leibrandt, né? Who's landed at Lambert's Bay of Port Nolloth or something? That crazy scheme to, you know, assist the Ossawa Brandwacht to, I don't know, Klimpert or something and overthrow the government. But it's yourself to ding met the Irse. There's Sean, what's his name, who's landed by boat off island, off a German ship in order, you know, opstoke and so on. So the Irish are very kind of divided, and the Irish are very strongly German in the Second World War. You know, Ossawa Brandwacht here sympathies with the Germans. And it's complicated in Canada. Canada is Quebecois, that's France, you know. South Africa is divided, maar is ook aan 'n plek wat afskeiding hê. Ja.
There are South Africans who've never participated in any war. Mm. I mean, they just decided from the beginning, second.
Yeah. And in hierdie plek is dit maklik. Daar's geen konflik.
It was easier for us. Yes.
Ja. Sit arms vou en wag of kyk. I mean, I end the book with what's that woman, Cherubin Dovey, that writer who's now in Australia, and she had this nice sticky in the Joburg Times about she was trying to write about the First World War in her family in the Eerste Wereldoorlog. So sy begin navorsing en krap deur die papiere en die briewe en die joernale so of een man te vind in die familie wat in die Eerste Wereldoorlog geveg het. Of iets gedoen vir die oorlog. En wat het sy gevind? Niks. Nie een mens in haar familie, nie 'n vrou wat 'n verpleegde werk doen. Niks. En sy sê, wat was die betekenis van hierdie navorsing, en die betekenis vir die navorsing was vir mense, en dit was 'n Engelse, 'n wit Engelse, patriotiese, pro-empire familie. En die betekenis vir die Eerste Wereldoorlog was niks. Is nie ons eerlik. Is ver af. Dat is nie gevaar vir ons hier nie. Nie redelik gevaar. Dat is propaganda en so, maar dat is nie redelik gevaar. Wat, I mean, ons woon nie in Kent of Sussex, wag vir die Duitse wat oor die English Channel kom. Ons woon hier in Kaapstad. Dit is nie ons oorlog nie.
We were a part of, but also not, and also what other countries have learned internationally through the wars, and us as outsiders, that we've still got to maybe... It's so difficult to really perceive the situation of South Africans during the first and second, because
ja, en dat's ook aan die kant as groot patriots en mense wat ja ons weet ja mense hierdie plek take 1914 there are South Africans who are working in London they botanists at Kew Gardens or whatever and hier kom die oorlog en Boete en Smuts is nou in die oorlog. En hulle sit in Londen en hulle kyk en wat sien hulle? Dit is nie 'n plek wat heeltemal enthousiasties is vir die oorlog. So hulle kom nie huis toe nie. They join the British Army or the British Navy in Britain. En Smuts en Boot is baie vies daaroor. So hulle sê, ja, dit is 'n probleem. Maar hulle is nie Suid-Afrikaners daar. Ons hulle moet huis toe kom. And for ons veggies was hulle Afrikaners. So they're kind of losing their identity. So I've got something about it in the book, but I think it's an interesting kind of issue, you know.
Wereld word... Dame, gou, asseblief, dankie.
Goeiemôre. Ek wil net 'n anekdotetjie vertel. Ek was eers nie geïnteresseerd in Wêreldoorlog 1 nie, totdat ek saam met Belgiese mense in België getuie het, en ons daar na die slagvelde toe is daar.
Oh ja, Ypres, Passchendaele, ja.
Dat is baie aangrypend om daar duisende wit kruisies en grafstene te sien. En daar het ek eintlik asof vir die eerste keer gesien dat Suid-Afrika daar deelgeneem het, want daar's rye en rye grafies waarop net staan, Here lies the South African, now and unto God.
Ja, dit is reg.
Hulle weet nie eers wie dit is wat daar lê nie, maar dit kon om en dan sien 'n mens die springbok kop op daardie grafsteentjie en dit is nogal opvallend. Selfs was ons in die Duitse begraafplaas gewees, wat eintlik nog meer
donker, né, met swart kruise en so. Nee.
Wat my daar opgevang is 'n standbeeld wat gemaak is deur Kate Polwich, die Duitse.
Nou, jy is reg, jy is heeltemal reg, ja. Ja, die Suid-Afrikaans, die Suid-Afrikaners in België het dit baie geniet. En die Vlaam met Vlaams. Because in Antwerp, as hulle in Antwerp en so, kan die courante lees, met die mense praat. En wat sê party van die Belgers, hoekom is julle nie swart nie? Because julle kom from Afrika af. Julle is die verkeerde kleur.
Enige ander vraag, dames en heren? Daar is nog een, gauw, alsjeblieft, dankie, jammer hoor.
Ja, don't please tell us a bit more about the Black Soldiers in Parliament.
Yeah.
The Mendi, yeah, I mean, I think this is embarrassing because I'm sitting in the company of the real authority on black experience in the First World War, my colleague Albert Grinling, who I see is hiding in the corner. You might have a sense of, I mean, obviously in the Cape you have the Cape Corps, who serve as armed troops. I mean, they are armed. Africans are restricted to sort of non-combatant roles. The government has the same problem with mobilizing black South Africans that they have with white South Africans. They can never mobilize enough. So they're always short of, you know, these demands come from the, or these requests come from the Imperial War Cabinet. Can you supply X number? And they can only supply, you know, whatever. But they can never supply the quotas. And then, of course, the great symbolic thing with the Mendi, you know, the Mendi is sunk in an accident. I mean, two ships collide in the English Channel in February 1917, and the Mendi sinks. And over 600 African non-combatant laborers lose their lives. And it's quite a poignant moment because what happens is that Louis Botha leads a moment of silence in the South African Parliament when that happens. And that's quite often left out of the historical record. It's it's the first time, possibly the only time, when a white parliament in South Africa observes and recognizes the black death on that scale. We're living in a period now where I suspect by the time we get to 2017, a great deal will be made of the Mendi, because I think we're living in a new nationalist period, and so you'll get a rediscovery, I think, of black experience and black participation in the war. The other thing to say is, of course, like white troops, the Cape Corps went to parts of the world in which South Africa never had any sort of contact. So the Cape Corps goes to East Africa, and the Cape Corps goes to Palestine, and is involved in the campaigns there. And of course, has also left a separate set of memories around that First World War experience.
Thank you.
Paul and Johan, baie baie dankie. It was really interesting. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks for being here. Baie dankie dat julle hier was. Ons gaan nou vir Bill aanstuur na die boekwinkel toe, waar sy boek te koop is, en waar hy sekerlik vir julle sal boeke teken as julle die boek koop.
Baie dankie. Baie dankie.